Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the April 8th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here across the table. He's an economist, the host of the Capital Record podcast, the author of Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life, and of course, the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David, and welcome to California.
Hello, Will. Yes, it's good to be visiting here in California. What a beautiful weather.
Amazing.
You guys have out here.
Isn't it fantastic? Welcome. You're going to love it here. And
I can see why people like living here. The weather's beautiful. What's the tax situation like?
It's as dark as the apocalypse. You are coming. You arrive in the office on a day when we're going to have an eclipse. Are you a fan of astronomy?
Let's just talk about something else. This thing is so obnoxious.
Let's talk about this then.
What is wrong with people? You know that New York had a 4.8 earthquake on Friday, and people have been talking about it all weekend.
Yes.
One of my clients is the mayor of a town in New Jersey. He got interviewed on Fox about it. And now, this is somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but they were selling T-shirts that day of, like, I survived the New York earthquake. So just so that part, I don't mind at all, the humor of it, but, like, the drama of everything. And then this eclipse thing, it's just, doesn't anyone have a job? I swear.
But let me ask you this. Were you in New York?
I was in my office. I was on a phone call.
Did you feel it?
Yeah, I felt it. It felt like an airplane flew by.
Huh. And that was it. Well, yeah. Airplane in New York.
The building that we're in New York, we're moving to a new office on 6th Avenue, and it's a newer building that we'll be moving to. The one we're in now is a very historic building called the Gray Bar Building, and it's been renovated over the years, but it was built like 100 years ago. And we're on the 22nd floor. And we're high enough up that, like, you feel it, but, like, nothing was even crooked on the wall.
Hmm.
So it's one of those things of, like, I got to pull my California street cred card. And they're like, David, are you okay? I'm like, what? Yes. Am I okay? I was there during Northridge. Like, that Northridge quake, and I was in Orange County, mm-hmm. It felt like 5 minutes
yes.
long.
Yes, that was real.
I'm sure it wasn't 5 minutes, but it felt like 5 minutes.
Yes.
This thing felt like 20 seconds, and you were kind of like, that could have been an earthquake. I don't know. And it turns out it was.
Hmm.
But 4.8?
Not a lot.
I don't even get out of bed for less than 7.2. Okay.
And then you're thrown out.
Yeah.
So much to get to here today, David. The story that I want to start with, if you don't mind, is last Friday. You and I are recording, as I say, on Eclipse Day, Monday, April the 8th. On Friday, that would have been the 7th, 6th, 5th, take off my socks, yeah, April 5th, here's the headline from the LA Times, 19 Pomona College protesters arrested after storming, occupying president's office. David, here's what happened. 18 pro-Hamas, or as they might have put it, pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel protesters stormed the president's office at Pomona College, just east of where you and I sit and talk right now. And they occupied her office, and the president threatened each of the students. She just said, like, look, man, you're out of here in 10 minutes, or I'm calling the cops, you're going to be arrested, and I will kick you out of school. The protesters did not take her seriously, and in fact, one of the protesters allowed 50 others to come crowding in. Guess what? Cops showed up. 19 total people were arrested and marched through a massive gathering outside the building at Pomona College. They were released early the next morning and indeed received suspension letters from school. You are not invited to go to classes here anymore. You are not allowed to come onto campus anymore. You can't have any interaction with student groups. You are gone. Now, the students have...
Expelled.
Expelled. You
but
are
no,
out.
But no... they were arrested.
They were arrested.
And charges are filed, or do they...
Charges are filed. It's misdemeanor protest, trespass.
Okay, so as far as you know, law enforcement's going to see it through. They're not dropping charges yet.
That's as far as we know, yeah.
God, this is such a great...
But what's...
How encouraging... I mean, this is how low the bar is. There's somebody storming the frickin' president's office, and we're, like, proud of the president for expelling him.
She's an African-American woman, and...
That's totally irrelevant to me.
It's not, because apparently the protesters were shouting racial epithets.
Oh, well, that's
from outside.
Were they?
Yes. So these are people who are...
Against whitey or against...
Against a black person. It's
That's hard to believe. They were...
That's just what the president of the university says.
Like N-word stuff?
That's what it sounds like. The LA Times discreetly doesn't tell us what the inflammatory phrase was.
I would think there'd be a lot of anti Jewish stuff going on, right?
Oh, you'd think.
This animating issue was pro-Palestine, pro-Hamas,
yes.
pro-Gaza.
Yeah,
pro-
so the way it works was that these...
Pro-October 7th, basically.
Yes, pro-October 7th. Sure. These students had a wall they called the Apartheid Wall, which, you know, depicts what they say is the evidence of Israeli occupation and destruction and genocide.
Shows an incredible historical understanding of what apartheid was.
That's right. And it was left up past a deadline at which the school said, look, we got stuff to do, pull it down, you know, take it down now. And they wouldn't, so some staff showed up in pickup trucks to begin dismantling it, and that's when the chaos started. 18 people stormed the office, and then 50 more let in. And you can see video of this online where the president of the university is just out there just telling them, like, look, I'm not kidding. You got 10 minutes. This is Ronald Reagan with the air traffic controllers. You've got 10 minutes. Get out. And, you know, unlike most people, as somebody said online, man, she did not bring cookies to these kids. But you know who did? Were a couple of professors who showed up and dutifully spoke to the LA Times about what was really going on here. One of those professors said, let's see, she said many of the students identify as people of color and that many of those that had coalesced around the wall were students from marginalized communities who had just found solidarity in the movement. This is a group of students, she said, who have found solace in each other and in the movement as a whole. Mm. Therefore, I guess, let them do whatever the hell they want. By the way,
that's one of the most illiberal things I've ever heard. And it reminds me of the Believe All Women line.
Yes.
That I take so seriously women not being abused by men that I don't want to say something so patronizing to women as Believe All Women.
Right.
Because obviously some women lie, and women are not to be treated like some kind of second-class citizen, that you make up special rules for them that doesn't make any sense in reality. So because I respect women, in a liberal society, I actually want due process, you know, evidence, hear things out, run an investigation, do things the way you're supposed to do. And it's illiberal to say Believe All Women. That's my view of it, and it's rooted in a high regard for the human person. In this case, saying, well, these are people of color, so we want them to have a right to do something others don't have the right to do, that is so demeaning.
It would seem to be.
You're a person of color, so you don't know right from wrong?
Yes.
What the hell kind of ethic is that?
Or the right and
wrong. And it's racial garbage.
Yeah. So... It's fascinating. The LA Times goes way out of its way to even use the language of, you know, solidarity and to bear witness. Let me see if I can find that wonderful line here. I can't find it. I'm sorry. But it's the LA Times story reads like a kind of protest tract itself, that, you know, these students were just here to protest and bear witness to what was going on in Israel. So anyway, just, you know, just a small story, not a major piece of news, except that it is so refreshing to see a university president say, no, no more BS. Okay, keeping with the theme that, you know, these are minor stories, but they actually reveal something important. There was a great story in Cal Matters that sort of summed up a campaign that had been building over the years. Gavin Newsom has claimed forever that the only reason he was able to go to college, because he was so poor, had a single mom, etc. This is a story that Gavin Newsom tells. I was the child of a single mother. And if it hadn't, and I was dyslexic, I had a learning disability, and if it hadn't been for my talent in baseball, I would never have been able to go to a four-year university because I got a scholarship and I played at Santa Clara. Alexei Kosev at Cal Matters did a really complete rundown of what happened here. He says that, in fact, let's set this up the way that Newsom does. He writes here, through his rise over the last two decades, his baseball career has provided Newsom a triumphant narrative to push back on the perception that his upbringing was privileged and easy. The high school standout was scouted by the major leaguers, he overcame his dyslexia and academic shortcomings to earn a partial scholarship to Santa Clara before an injury forced him to find a new purpose. Newsom told the story himself in January on the Pod Save America podcast. Because of poor test scores, he was headed to community college until he got the call from baseball coaches at Santa Clara University. Quote, it was literally the ticket to a four-year university. It changed my life, my trajectory. The truth is, Kosef reveals, that a deeper look at his recruitment reveals that Newsom's admission was substantially boosted by friends and acquaintances of his father, William Newsom, a San Francisco judge and financial advisor to the Getty family. One associate connected Newsom to the baseball program when he was in high school while his father's best friend, and then member of the university's Board of Regents, wrote him a letter of recommendation. Now, there is nothing wrong with how Newsom got to Santa Clara. He had family friends who were able to endorse his character, and he got in, and of course he's done well. Look at the guy, governor of the largest state and one of the most important world leaders in human history.
The last part.
You know, I'm being sarcastic, but it's just the need to sort of obscure his privilege.
Yeah, but isn't this a common thing that I don't think is about left wing or right wing politics? It seems to me that there is a human psychology level that, very honestly, is totally above my pay grade, or below my pay grade, because I just have no. Will, get your cup. We spill on aisle three. Will, get the cup. Do not spit in my studio, for God's sake. What I meant by below my pay grade is that it's something I don't even want to have to think about. Okay, but I'm sorry for my timing. Have you thought about just going beverage free?
I really should.
Not just when we record, but maybe all day. Okay, but like Hillary Clinton was obviously one of the top five most famous women of all time. And in our country was one or two, because this was before Tay-Tay. Hillary was probably the most famous woman in the country 10 years ago, right? 20 years ago?
I say, sure.
And making up stories about being shot at in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden's been doing it his whole life.
Yes.
This guy's the president.
Yeah.
He was the 8-year vice president. Before that, he was already a reasonably accomplished guy, being a senator for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And he would just say stuff about going to a black college or his son dying. And his son did die, a horrifically sad situation. He's lied his whole life about how
his first wife died.
Saying he got hit by a drunk driver and the guy wasn't a drunk driver.
Yeah. Just vilify that guy.
But what is the deal when people... I think it's wrong, just so we're clear, if someone is lying to help a story get better. Like, I would say, don't lie, okay?
Right.
But what does someone lie for when they don't need to lie? It's an old Kevin Nealon skit in Saturday Night Live, and I really recommend people go find it, where he would say, like, what did I possibly have to gain by lying about this one? He would just make something up at a party, and then someone would ask a follow-up question, and he didn't know what to say. But he was lying for no reason. He's like, I just said something. And in this baseball thing with Santa Clara, all I could think of is you just forget about Google.com?
Yeah. Well,
like, you just don't think people are going to be able to find out?
I think when he started telling the story, there was no Google.com. But listen, there are two takes on it.
Oh, he was telling the story a long time ago?
Yes, yeah. He's been telling it for a while. But here's a guy who pitched for two seasons at the school and now runs a pitching academy in San Francisco. His name is Kevin Schneider. He's quoted in the story in Cal Matters. Speaking of Newsom, he says, and the baseball story, he says, he didn't earn it. He did not earn the right to say it. I worked my ass off. So did everybody else in that team. So for him to just go all these years to say he did something he didn't do, that takes not just talent, but also dedication and sacrifice. That's just not right. Now, here's how Newsom's spokesperson describes what happened. Well, he says, Newsom speaks about his baseball journey with, quote, emotional, real truth that is visceral to him. Think about this with the Pomona College thing we just described, where the students belong to marginalized communities and therefore feel like they have the right to occupy the president's office. This is our governor, and this is his spokesperson. We all go through life. The guy's name is Nathan Click, by the way. He's a spokesperson for the governor. He says, we all go through life and remember the emotions we feel about things, not, you know, facts. He chooses to talk about the emotional side of it because he thinks that is the place that young people in particular who are going through struggles, people with dyslexia, can find themselves in his story. That matters way more than, you know, whether he was a rostered player or what his stats were in fall ball, JV, freshman year, Santa Clara University. That's what we have here, David. We get to make up things so long as we feel passionate about them. And we have an honest desire to connect with others. But it really does come down to just privilege. The reporter, again, just points out that he was so eager to secure his spot at the university that Newsom's family solicited letters of recommendation from former Governor Jerry Brown, who attended Santa Clara for a year, and then appointed William Newsom to the Superior Court. That's That's Gavin's dad. And the state... So, Jerry Brown writes a letter of recommendation, or at least is solicited for a letter of recommendation. And why? Because Jerry Brown appointed Gavin Newsom's dad, William, to the Superior Court and the State Court of Appeal during his first term as governor. So this is a guy who has always been very well connected. What's the old saying? Born on third base, thinks he hit a triple.
Exactly. Yeah. But the difference there is that expression was made for someone who really doesn't know the difference. A real Tommy boy that does not know. Gavin obviously knows.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think that that's what Gavin's done here is worse.
I just love a real Tommy boy. That was a deep cut. Adam Sandler movie?
No.
No?
Chris Farley and David Spade.
Oh, I'm sorry. But it is, isn't it Adam Sandler's company that produced it, the whatever it's called?
Is that what you're going for, is the production company?
I don't remember. That's terrible.
This would have been before Happy Madison.
Thank you. You're good.
Billy Madison.
Yeah, I think Happy Madison.
Madison's the company. Yeah. But no, Tommy Boy's before that.
Okay. And it is David Spade and
Chris Farley.
Chris Farley.
May he rest in peace.
That's great. Yeah.
Moment of silence for Chris. Listen, Will, are you okay? You were
I'm touched.
No, the beverage.
Oh, well, everything smells like coffee right now.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I should be much more careful. I'm just really thirsty. And then when you do that... there was more bad news. It is a very difficult week for Gavin Newsom. So you got this kind of modest takedown, which, you know, Gavin Newsom could hurdle quite easily and generally does with statements like, I believed it viscerally. But it was also the week when we learned that India will likely soon replace California as the world's fifth largest economy. Here's the story. In 2022, you'll remember, David, because we talked about it, Bloomberg's news editor-in-chief emeritus, a guy named Matthew Winkler, predicted that California would soon overtake Germany to become the world's fourth largest economy. And Gavin Newsom used that in a press release to say, while critics often say California's best days are behind us, reality proves otherwise. Our economic growth and job gains continue to fuel the nation's economy. But according to a special report from the California Center for Jobs and the Economy, not only is number four not in the cards, but the Golden State might actually slip to number six behind India. Now, I know, David, you're skeptical about these kinds of claims and reports in general, but I just do think it's fun to watch Gavin Newsom claim in 2022, look, this proves we're great, and then just sort of skip over the bad news when it appears here.
Well, I'm not skeptical of that. I agree. I would say is I'm never surprised by it. It's not that I'm skeptical.
Well, skeptical of the comparison, I think. I think you expressed at the time just skepticism about measuring a state's GDP because there's all kinds of other factors involved.
Yes, I think that it is a comparison of an apple to an orange, best case, more likely comparing an apple to a windowsill. And yet... your point is that what's sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander. If you're going to make the comparison when it's favorable, then make it when it's unfavorable. And my point is to you, okay, sure, except for, you know, they're politicians.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not going to do that.
So
it's like a band, and you go, like, sold out show.
Mm.
And then, like, the next night doesn't sell out, and they don't announce it. Like, hey, 30% empty seats. But, like, why would you expect them to do that?
You're right. It's fair. I don't expect. I just like to keep track. Hey, I want to do a couple of quick ad reads, if you don't mind, for National Review. The first one is I just want to remind people that I will be among very celebrated contributors to National Review who are attending two events. April 30th here in Newport Beach, the other in San Jose the next day, May 1st. They'll run from 3 in the afternoon to 5:30. That's on April 30th in Newport Beach and San Jose on May 1st, 3 o'clock to 5:30, with cocktails and conversation afterward. The really renowned speakers include Janice Rogers Brown, former California Supreme Court Justice, NRI's Lindsey Craig, Rich Lowry, National Review editor, of course, Ramesh Panuru, editor of the magazine, and UC Berkeley Law Professor John Yu. Cannot wait to hear him. Registration details and precise locations are in the show notes. I hope to see you all there.
You know who my favorite speaker of all those is?
Who's that?
John Yu.
I can't wait to see John Yu.
You thought I was going to see you.
No.
I did see you. John Yu.
Thank God there's no coffee in my...
Yeah. I timed that purposely. You're going to do phenomenal. All the guests that are there are going to benefit from hearing you. I think you know I have to miss that day.
Yeah.
I have to... I fly out that morning at like 5:30 in the morning... for a big work event I cannot miss on the East Coast. But that is that's some serious heavyweights.
It's quite a lineup, yeah. It's quite a lineup and me. So I don't think I've asked you this. You're not going on the Alaska cruise this year for National Review?
I am not. I've never done a National Review cruise. Maybe one day it's something I might do later in life, but I can't go on a cruise.
It's a week.
For a week.
Yeah.
And also, I have a wife who doesn't like cruising. I have a job, a company. I just can't go on the cruise things. But I always thought it would be nice. I may end up doing it later in life, but now I'm a little...
Well, I hope you'll forgive me then, because I'm going to be on the Alaska cruise speaking on a couple of panels.
I do forgive you.
Thank you.
By the way, I've done a cruise before in Alaska with my family, and I can't even imagine doing Alaska any other way than a cruise, because you would never be able to see the things you can see apart from being down on those waterways.
It's amazing, isn't it? We went for my parents, I think, 50th anniversary. It was remarkable. One more NRI ad read here, and that is that... I'll just read it the way they've written it. And at National Review, we strive to bring you the best content across all platforms, including our podcasts, and that means always working to improve. To do that, we need your feedback. Please take a moment to complete our podcast survey. It's in the show notes. The link there is at nationalreview.com/survey. That's nationalreview.com/survey. And as I say, it's in the show notes. So take the survey and let National Review know how we can make podcasts better. All right. So, David, continuing with the bad news from Gavin Newsom, just want to ask you, I know you and I had a little back and forth on this. The jobs report came out, the federal jobs report came out on Friday. Here's the Associated Press headline. U.S. employers add a surprisingly robust 303,000 jobs in March in a sign of continued economic strength. David, I went through and, you know, played with the numbers a little bit to look at how they really look, and I have my own sense. Will you indulge me for just a moment, then you can tell me why I'm wrong. Okay. What I noticed was that the number of government jobs is rising dramatically, much faster than other job categories. And if you take in this instance, in the Friday report, 71,000 of Joe Biden's jobs, if you want to call them Joe Biden's job, because I'm not sure how much the president really can increase economic activity except by subtracting. Subtracting that is regulation and taxes and that sort of thing. But 71,000 jobs are new jobs are in government. And if you take those out of the job reports for January, February, and March, March totals were not that great. Marginally better than February, about 10,000 jobs better than February, but far worse than January's number. So I'm not saying, I'm always delighted to see more Americans working than fewer. This is a great thing. Want to give credit where credit is due. To the extent that Joe Biden can claim any credit for this, fair enough. But I was intrigued because one of the first tweets I saw about this came from our own Gavin Newsom, and he wrote, "Can't wait to see how Fox News spins this one." Well, one way to look at it, and I wouldn't call it a spin, is to say that, in fact, perhaps it's not quite as good as the major media would have it. And then I wanted to, you know, just point out that the other way that Fox News or even we might point out is the irony here that, you know, Gavin Newsom is talking about how great the economy is, and yet California has still the worst unemployment rate in the nation, according to the same bureau that released that jobs report.
Although this tweet is only talking about the national unemployment.
That's correct. But I'm just saying that at the same time he's talking about how great the economy is, the same numbers come out, or the same department comes out, Department of Labor comes out with its own report on unemployment in February and March, and it shows California at the bottom in terms of employment. So we've got India overtaking us internationally. We've got every other state exceeding us, excelling, surpassing us in terms of employment numbers. You know, Gavin Newsom can crow about Joe Biden's national performance, I suppose, if he'd like to. But the fact is that might be seen to be spinning away from the really inconvenient truth that California's unemployment rate remains stubbornly high. Okay, David, that's an awful lot, and you're the economist, so...
Well, I don't think I've ever disagreed with you more since we've been doing this podcast.
Please.
I really don't. I think Gavin Newsom's 100% right about... I can't wait to see how Fox News spins this one. The gymnastics I've seen people on the right try to do the last 4 days on the employment report is just embarrassing. First of all, it's 72,000 government jobs, 71,000 out of 303, 1 month. Go back year over year. The government jobs created over a 12-month period are less than the percentage of total jobs they represent in the economy. It has been disproportionately higher. The construction jobs have been negative, and this last month they were up 39,000. I'm looking at the data right now. The fact of the matter is that total non-farm payroll, you could argue about wages. My biggest issue is still unaddressed, which is the labor participation force. Is it now? It went up 0.2% last month, but it's at 62.7. It had been at 62.5. And 15, 16 years ago, it was at 67.5. 5% of a labor participation force of 167 million people, there is something close to 15 million people that have left the job force voluntarily. Hmm. That is all I care about. But within the numbers of who wants a job and is able to get one, it is simply undeniable that this has been a robust jobs market. Now, people could say the Biden job market, that's a fallacy, but every Republican's just going to do it. Because if it's bad news, they're going to say it's Biden's fault. Right. If it's good news, they're going to say it was because of Trump. And we've been playing this little idolatrous game for 30 years, and no one can get out of it. But this is just simply unspinnable. 496,000 household survey last month. No illegal aliens are in the household survey. You had a... basically now on a 3-month, 6-month, 9-month, 12-month, and 24-month period, the lowest rolling cycles of initial jobless claims. That's the number that really matters, because in America, when one loses their job, they go file for unemployment. Mm-hmm. You have a historically low amount of people filing for unemployment. Hmm. So if someone wants to claim that, no, there's really a lot of hidden job losses out there and the government's skewing the books, and there's just a bunch of people that decided not to go get the money that they paid for it, that we have had a cultural shift and that people no longer file for unemployment, then I guess they have an argument I'm not going to know what to do with. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, the data skews to the fact that we have a very healthy jobs market. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why people think that's a political issue.
So, no, I'm completely with you, which is why I'm trying to say always delighted when people are able to find jobs and worthwhile remunerative work. I think that's an awesome thing. But I still think, you know, Newsom's question about spin begs the question of why California lags so far behind.
No, that's
behind.
The second point you brought
I understand.
Up. That point should be all we talk about with Gavin. I'm with you 100%. You and I know the answer because we talk about it every week for seven years. California is hurting with job markets because a bunch of people left the state and a bunch of employers have left, so there aren't jobs here, and they've hollowed out the middle class, and it's an overly unionized state.
That's it, yeah.
Taxes, regulation, crime, homelessness.
Yep.
Santa Clara baseball right now is there's not a lot of opportunities. So we know that stuff. But like I this is a big deal to me because we are stuck and we are not even trying to get off the mousetrap of idolizing federal government role in the economy to where a data point is presumed to be a good thing or a bad thing for a person in office, which is rank messianic view of politics. There is a million reasons why job losses could go up and it's not a politician's fault. Mm-hmm. And there's a million reasons why jobs could be created and it's not a politician's glory. And yet we have just made this thing inescapably linked to the person who's in office to a point where I know as a fact people are sitting there cheering when it's a bad jobs number or a bad inflation number, a bad CPI number, and they're cheering when it's a good one, all depending on tribal and partisan loyalties. That is just totally unbecoming of a society like America. And I know you want people to be employed, but I want us to understand the part I'm disagreeing with you on, because you agree with me on everything I just said. Mm-hmm. It is not a weak jobs report because 71,000 government jobs. 71,000 out of 303,000 is very close to its representation in the economy.
Got it.
And over a year, it's about less than the overall representation.
I'll take that. Thank you. Well done.
Now, I'd like that representation of the economy to lower. I would rather have less government employees in our economy, but it isn't a weaker aspect of the job. Like, we have what we have, and those people are having jobs, and so it's like, okay. But you're not saying, look, we're not getting people to get, there's no jobs to be found at XYZ private company, so they're having to now go to the DMV. I mean, that's sort of what people are trying to say around that data point, and it's very disingenuous.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that when the government grows, you're going to have higher employment. Typically,
but these jobs being created in the government are not a sign of government. We don't have more government payroll.
We do in California.
No, I'm federally. This is a BLS. This is a National Jobs Report.
I'll try to stick with what I know, which is just California.
But Gavin didn't stick with what he knew, and you were responding to Gavin. Yeah. Gavin was making a federal point. But even then, what Gavin did was accurate. He said, can't wait to see how the right's going to spin this. And then the right went on to try to spin it.
Right. And I regard the question that he asked as itself a kind of spin.
I regard it as politically smart on his part.
Okay.
But you already know I love the guy.
I was just say you admire him in some respects. You admire him the way that some people admire the devil. Okay, so to continue with Gavin Newsom's difficult week, another piece comes out, and this is in the Wall Street Journal, been covered by some local outlets. Gavin Newsom pays $16 per hour. This is all a story that is linked to the fact that Gavin Newsom signs AB 257. That's the Fast Food Act. And I'm not going to get into the weeds and point out that there was a further bill that kind of represented a deal between the International Franchise Association and its larger members and the Newsom administration. But the bottom line is AB 257 raised the minimum wage to $20 per hour in the fast food industry. And the Wall Street Journal says, so what gives with Gavin Newsom's restaurants advertising jobs for just $16 per hour? According to a job post, the Wall Street Journal reports, the worker would be required to prepare coffee, espressos, cappuccinos as directed, make the manager aware of guest comments, etc. If only Democratic lawmakers were as responsive to their constituents. This is Gavin Newsom looking for the Plump Jack Cafe, which is one of his properties near Lake Tahoe, is offering a $16 an hour job for a part-time busser, they call it. Mr. Newsom founded the Plump Jack Group as a wine shop in 1992. His hospitality business has expanded to include 4 wineries and 4 restaurants and bars. And it's fascinating that the $20 minimum wage goes up for fast food companies, but not for companies like Gavin Newsom's. What the Wall Street Journal asks, what is the difference? They say here, tech bros in San Francisco might be able to afford an $8 Big Mac, but lower income folks in Fresno, not so much. Now, Newsom's office said immediately that they actually put all of this stuff, that Newsom put all of this stuff into a blind trust. Therefore, he can't possibly take any responsibility for what's going on there. But I'm going to hand it to him. California GOP spokesperson. We don't normally quote the Republican Party of California, but here goes. Quote, Gavin Newsom is still prominently featured as the founder of Plump Jack. The company's website links to Newsom's campaign page. His sister currently runs Plump Jack. It sends a pretty mixed message to businesses struggling to implement his disastrous new law when the governor's own family-run business doesn't feel compelled to follow it. So, let's move on real quickly here, David, because I know we're tight. Let's see. So, Newsom, we've been talking about the budget, massive budget deficit. We've talked about this at great length. I don't want to go into it too much except to say that Newsom still insists that he's going to manage this by June 30. That's the deadline by which California must balance its budget. But to reprise, 2 years ago in 2022, Newsom proclaims, hey, we've got a $100 billion surplus. Now his own state auditors, controllers, and others say, no, it's actually closer to $73 billion deficit. This is a massive, massive swing in the wrong direction. So Newsom has gone to work with the legislature trying to figure out how they're going to throw everything overboard that's not nailed to some kind of constitutional requirement. And their plan so far for $17 billion in cuts, remember the top number we're looking for is $73 billion. Newsom took about $13 billion out of the rainy day funds, now we're down to $60. They found $17 billion more. And it calls the plan between the two parties, Newsom and the legislative leaders, calls for delaying $1 billion in grant funding for transit and rail, saving $762 million for pausing on hiring those open state jobs, and pulling $500 million from a program to help school districts pay for K-12 building projects, among other proposals. There's a lot in there, but I think the bottom line is that they're doing the best they can, Newsom and the legislature, to cut programs that will not really affect jobs that unions control, despite the fact that they're going to pause on hiring and filling vacancies. I mean, that is a big deal. We'll see how that flies with the unions after they try to.
So what's an example of jobs that they are going to cut that do not affect unions?
They're not cutting the jobs. They're just not filling vacancies.
And what's an example of those sectors?
They could be in the DMV, for instance. That's a state agency.
They're not unionized?
They are unionized. They're all these are unionized. So the question, the open question is, will the unions go along with this? Because virtually everybody in the state legislature, and Newsom himself, has had their campaigns bankrolled by the
way,
government.
I think they should hire more at the DMV. It's a very long line. Let's add to those government payrolls.
But what's interesting, David, is that you've got progressives on the back foot here. You know, most of the cuts are in things like rail, you know, heavy-duty transit programs. That's the billion-dollar deal right there. You've got cuts in climate programs.
God, if they slow down the high-speed rail,
it might
that could end up delaying its completion. You know what I'm saying?
I do. I know precisely what you're saying.
Right now, they're on track to be done in the year 3,400. But this could extend it at a millennium.
The technology will still be brand new and cutting edge. So what's really fascinating is to watch how progressives have turned, in the legislature, have turned their focus, David, from adding new spending to going after either tax increases or, even worse, just really going after private sector businesses, you know, like by more highly regulated, so they can go back to their members and say, like, look what I did. I punished, you know, this business sector, this class of rich people. I'll give you an example of the ways in which unions are fighting back that doesn't have to do with spending more budgeted cash. That's Senate Bill 1446, which is, here's its wonderfully mellifluous title, Grocery Establishment and Retail Drug Establishment Employees, Self-Service Checkout and Technologies Affecting Essential Job Functions. That's Senate Bill 1446. The author is Lola Smallwood Cuevas. Now, the authorship is important because Smallwood Cuevas represents a part of LA, but before that she worked for SEIU, that's the Service Employees International Union, and she started the UCLA Job Center. And I point this out because the UCLA Job Center was one of the major proponents of AB 257, which we just spoke about, David. That's the Fast Food Act. So the Job Center comes out with a report which says you've got to have a higher minimum wage and better working standards in the fast food industry because injuries and horror show stuff going on inside the fast food industry is just terrible and it affects people of color. So Smallwood Cuevas is at SEIU and then becomes head of the UCLA Job Center. And as you dig into the UCLA Job Center's report in support of AB 257, you discover this interesting feature. That is that the UCLA Labor Center actually relied for its information on SEIU self-reporting. So they outsource the job. UCLA's Job Center comes up with a report and they outsource the finding of evidence about injuries in the workplace to SEIU. So who's at the center of this? Lola Smallwood Cuevas is the center of the AB 257 report. And all these emails that have been released, I'll put a link in the show notes, but I've cited this before. All of this, let me just read from what I wrote before about this. Many media reports banging the drum for AB 257 have relied on a UCLA Labor Center study, sorry, it's called the Labor Center, that claimed to discover that working at your favorite burger joint is like cobalt mining. Vox cited UCLA's finding that 43% of workers experienced workplace injury or illness. Nearly half experienced verbal abuse, and a quarter said they were retaliated against by their managers for reporting workplace issues. Those claims were repeated in the LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, Cal Matters, Sacramento Bee, and others. And reporters were so eager to amplify that story about industrial wage theft and workplace injuries and medieval exploitation that nobody paused to examine the UCLA study itself. And it was only when those internal UCLA documents revealed email exchanges between SEIU and the Labor Center showing that the Labor Center was allowing SEIU to put together all the claims of workplace harassment and violence and underpayment. So the study was completely junk, not a huge surprise. Who is the founder of the UCLA Labor Center? Oh, it's Lola Smallwood Cuevas. She is a project director there right now. While she is in the state Senate, this former SEIU organizer is still one of the project directors at UCLA.
You're telling me that UCLA hired someone that was insular to their school, that was conflicted and not qualified?
I am.
I was talking about Deshaun Foster, the new football coach.
Football time.
But you said that one up for me perfectly. I didn't even listen to anything else you said. That was
UCLA conflict? Football.
But I mean, they literally hired their old running back from the 90s, this little fumble machine named Deshaun Foster, as their new head coach. And everything you just said about this gal is just rank cronyism. Unqualified conflict, the whole deal. This isn't a critique of UCLA, by the way. It's just the state. It's just so corrupt and pitiful. I can't even believe the story I just heard.
We're going to turn it into an SAU UCLA story. Hey, but here's what's fascinating about this bill, David.
You know what's funny?
Please.
I think if we had her be the football coach and Deshaun Foster be in charge of the program,
things might be,
it would be a negligible difference in result. And I'm being 100% serious.
Well, here's her bill, David. This grocery establishment and retail drug establishment employees self-service checkout and technologies. One of the problems we've discussed about AB 257 is that if you raise labor from $16 to $20 per hour without any sort of consultation with the business owner, you will have increased the cost of labor, and you're going to have a bunch of unintended but utterly predictable consequences. Number one, you're going to cut jobs, and you're going to replace people with machines. So SB 1446, though it is not in the restaurant business, is adjacent, and what would it do? It would try to stop the implementation of automated solutions to things like checkout. So, you know, the self-checkout at a grocery store, if you've ever used one, and if you haven't, you've probably been dead for a few years. But the self-checkout thing, she wants to stall out. So the former SEIU person who was behind the corrupt study at UCLA that backed AB 257, which led directly to job losses, now wants to stop those job losses by making it more difficult for businesses to implement a self-checkout. Specifically, what she says is, oh, this would just require a study of the impact of implementing self-checkout kiosks and that sort of thing. But here's how the study works. You have to do the study. And that takes, you know, however much time. But before that, you have to post a 60-day notice that the study will take place. So 60 days in advance of launching the study, you have to notify all of your employees, we're going to do a study, and you have to invite them to participate in the study. The study takes however long the study takes, and then it must be posted for 90 days before implementation. So there's just, even if you did everything, like if you did that study the same day that the 60-day clock ran out, you would still have 5 months of studying. But the study has to be posted for 90 days before you can implement, and God knows if what your study is going to quote-unquote uncover. If SEIU does the study for you, or if UCLA does it, it's going to point out that you know, you're going to get injured, I don't know, by self-checkout. Yep. The bill would prohibit, here's from the bill itself, the bill would prohibit a grocery establishment or retail drug establishment from providing a self-service checkout option for customers unless specified conditions are satisfied, including having no more than 2 self-service checkout stations monitored by any single employee, and requiring that employee to be relieved of all other duties. So, you know, if there's a sudden need to move over someplace else because there's nobody at the checkout, you go help someone else. You can't do that. You have to be locked to these 2 machines just standing there and watching it. So I could go on, but this is a disastrous, stupid bill brought by a disastrously compromised UCLA staffer, faculty member. I'm not sure what you, I guess staffer is probably appropriate here, but who's also a former SEIU organizer and, of course, in our state Senate. And my point here, David, is just in saying that Gavin Newsom's budget now is so wrapped around its own axle, having to throw overboard a lot of progressive causes, that I think the progressive legislators like this woman are really working to just continue to press forward on employers in California, which will make, of course, the California economy sink a little more quickly. Okay, so in other wonderful and interesting news, Brian, are you about ready to hit us up with a sound? I want to talk about something that happened, a debate last week. We saw a debate on Assembly Bill 2319, David.
Oh, yeah, with Lori Wilson.
That's right. This is a bill that is brought by Assemblymember Lori D. Wilson, and Ms. Wilson says that what we really need is a new law that will require implicit bias training for medical professionals. Mm. We've been over this before. The idea is that if you're a white doctor, you can't possibly speak to black women, and therefore you're going to have to be trained to do this very difficult task of speaking to black women, because because, again, to your point, the soft bigotry of low expectations, black women and white doctors can't possibly understand one another. They're just such unique personalities. But buried in the law,
and well, that was definitely Dr. King's vision, wasn't it?
It really was. But buried in this proposal, Assembly Bill 239, is this weird thing.
2319.
I'm sorry. Yes, 2319. Buried in that is a line that seeks to reduce the effects of implicit bias in pregnancy and childbirth and postnatal care for a bunch of people, including all birthing people, including non-binary persons and persons of transgender experience. Think about that phrase for just a moment with me, David.
I actually can't think about it because I don't know what any of it means. Okay, now first for the serious part before I revert to being kind of sarcastic, but what is non-binary again?
It means that you don't self-identify as either straight or LGBTQ. You're nowhere on the spectrum of male or female.
Okay, is it about gender or sexuality?
That's a great question. I honestly don't know. I think it's about gender.
Because people use non-binary like everyone knows what it means, and I don't. I know what that means.
And you know what binary means.
And I know, but is the binary in this case...
I think it's male-female is all they're talking about.
So that I don't identify as either male or female.
Right.
It doesn't mean I don't identify as straight or gay.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Non-binary people, so they just don't identify as a man or a woman.
That's right.
They can give birth. Okay,
that's
I agree with that.
And
a woman who doesn't know she's a woman can still give birth.
Right.
Okay, so I agree with it. Now, the second part is that men of the transgender experience give birth?
Well, it says persons of transgender experience.
Because the link you sent quotes it as saying men.
Well, that's because that's what Lori Wilson said. Non-binary people and men of the... Let's go ahead and play the clip there, Brian, if you would, please.
A man does not have a cervix, a uterus, or a vagina. How could a man get pregnant? How would a baby come out of a man?
That non-binary people and men of the transgender experience give birth. Thank you for stating the obvious.
So that's activist Sophia Lori, and she was testifying before Wilson and Assemblymember Mia Bonta. Bonta was hosting the hearing, and Mia Bonta, of course, is in the Assembly seat that was once held by her husband, Rob Bonta, who's now the Attorney General. And together they have pushed for AB 2319. Wilson is a person who says, in response to Sophia Lori. Now, Sophia Lori is an activist who, along with others like Aaron Friday, was speaking. Sophia represents the California Family Council, and she was there to say, like, look, man, a man does not have a cervix, a uterus, or a vagina.
Listen,
how could a man get pregnant?
Can you just say uterus? Because of those three words, there's only one of them I'm comfortable hearing on this podcast. Uterus, I'm fine with. The other two words, can you just skip them?
Sure. How could a man get pregnant, Sophia Lori asks. How would a baby come out of a man? It's a very straightforward question, but it's Assemblymember Lori Wilson who says, well, look, you know, men of the transgender experience can give birth. So, David, I looked this up, and what I found out is that the word men of the transgender experience is really key here, because a transgender man cannot have a baby. There's zero question. I'm sorry. A man cannot have a baby. A woman can have a baby, right? Sophia Lori has that exactly right. But how about a woman who wants to pass it a man and so takes testosterone? I looked this up. There's a guy named Thomas Beatty who a few years ago, he's a woman. She's a woman. Thomas Beatty is. Despite the name, despite the fact that Thomas Beatty is the new name of this American woman, Thomas Beatty had a top surgery where the breasts were removed and then took testosterone to reduce the secondary male sex characteristics. And once she stopped taking the testosterone, hey presto, she was able to have a baby because in fact she is a woman. So yes, a transgender man, if by that you mean a woman who is taking drugs to make herself look like a man, yes, that person can stop taking testosterone and then have a baby. That does happen.
That's a woman.
That is a woman having a baby.
What am I? Why are we doing this?
Mostly just to show that the insanity continues.
Okay.
This is the idea. Assembly Bill 239 says, but David, I want to point out that it's like one of those grotesque English candies. I grew up in an English family, and you would have these amazing candies on the outside, and inside there'd be something like, I don't know, turpentine or, you know, a walnut or something. I mean, walnut, I could bet.
That's the most hideous thing I've ever heard.
It's disgusting. So inside this weird candy of white doctors need implicit bias training to work with black women is buried this thing about about transgenderism. And so you get a quote from one of the panel members, Reggie Jones Sawyer, a black minister, I want to point out, who has also been on the reparations committee, and we've talked a lot about Reggie Jones Sawyer over the time. He says, we have to protect all African Americans no matter what, and I'm not really understanding what the opposition is. The opposition to this bill is twofold. One, telling doctors that they are inherently biased before any kind of, I don't know, sort of proof of that, that you have implicit bias and therefore need the sensitivity training, is itself weird and interferes with the doctor relationship, which the left always says is sacrosanct when it comes to abortion, right? So the doctor-patient relationship is sacrosanct until we say it's not.
Yeah.
And it's not when it comes to dealing with black women. But again, buried in there like a disgusting British candy is this fact of transgenderism, in which we have Assembly Member Lori Wilson saying men of the transgender experience can give birth. And then you get Assembly Member Mia Bonta saying,
so the activist is the one who is saying stuff about how does a man without a uterus get pregnant?
Exactly.
And then she was responding to this assemblywoman who was saying this stuff. So, like, this, just, I don't want to talk about it. All this is a war on creational norms. That's it. The postmodern effort, it went from disagreeing with the thesis of Christian truths to now wanting to go to war with the vocabulary of Christian truths. And this is a 2024 example of something that you were observing at UCI and at USC in the 80s. This is Derrida. This is cultural Marxism. This is deconstructionism. Just played out.
Yes.
That's all it is. But like it's supposed to, it was like a John Lovitz stand-up comedy bit 5 years ago. And now it's serious. Yeah. And people are having these conversations.
Yes.
But to a point where, like, I wonder how many people know what non-binary means in the real world.
Well, most undergrads do who graduated from a California university in the last
years. Or anyone under 25, probably.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. Okay. Hey, I know you've got to get rolling here, so let me just run one last story by you. We've talked about the California regulator taking income-based electric bills. That was going to be that you're going to get a utility bill that was based on your income. New headlines say that's off the table now. We have found that it's not. I'm just going to read to you what the new proposal is. The new proposal would add smaller fixed monthly charges of $6 per month or $12 per month to customers who are signed up for two different utility special rate programs designed for low-income earners. So, on the one hand, the government is now saying, we aren't going to have income-based utility bills. We're just going to have these fixed monthly rates for poorer, low-income people. And then last story, David, I just want to run over is that California will become the first state to give workers a right to disconnect after hours. That's Assembly Bill 2751. Basically what it says is that workers should not be punished for not being available 24 hours a day if they're not being paid for 24 hours of work every day. I have found, David, that in terms of not taking phone calls from chairman of the board, donors, and others, that I just use those things at the end of my arms that are called hands to not pick up the call. There are ways to self-monitor this, but the government must get involved.
Sure.
All right, David. Well, that's all we've got here, but I'm going to pass over to an interview I've done with Lance Richardson about California's first black mayor, and that's how we'll wrap up this show.
Can you do me a favor next week?
Yeah.
You didn't get to a story about California giving up to $150,000 to help first-time home buyers. Can we do that next week?
Let's do it next week. Thank you, buddy. All right, so here's my conversation with Lance Christensen. Sarah, play that tape. All right, with me now is my friend and colleague, Lance Christensen. He's Vice President of Education, Policy, and Government Affairs at California Policy Center. Lance, welcome back to the show. Always great to have you.
Thank you, Will. Glad to be here.
You and I are here to talk about the 136th anniversary of California's first African-American mayor. That's Edward Parker Duplex, born 1830, died January 5th, 1900. He made it just about 70 years.
I'll just read, if I may, just real quickly, one paragraph from Wikipedia. He was an American entrepreneur, politician, and civil rights activist in California. He was a leader in the state's colored conventions movement, born in Connecticut, migrated to California during the gold rush, and was a partner in the Sweet Vengeance Mine. I cannot wait to talk about that. Duplex used his share of profits from that mine to start his own barbershop in Marysville, California, where he employed other black barbers, later moving to Wheatland, where his barbershop became one of the two longest-running businesses in the town. And in Wheatland, he becomes California's first African-American mayor, April 11th, that's this Thursday, 1888. And Lance, I would not have known Edward Duplex, but for a little road trip you and I took a few weeks back with some of our colleagues, and you pointed to a nondescript little building in a nondescript little rural town, Wheatland, and you said, hey, you may not know this, but that used to be the barbershop of California's first black mayor. And it was just remarkable in so many ways. Tell us about what you know about Edward Duplex. Tell me, maybe you can tell the listeners what the spot looks like. Because again, my memory may be wrong in this, but I feel like the street was so narrow, so little, that I could have reached out to the passenger window and touched this little building where Edward Duplex ran a barbershop in the 19th century.
So we have this frontier country where a lot of people were coming to discover gold for many years. And if you go through Yuba County and Sutter County, which is next door, this is where a lot of the storied history took, that goes, you know, pretty far and wide. And in the hills in this area was a lot of old Indian tribes, the Nisenan tribe and others. And so you've got this sort of storied history, but it was also a place where a lot of people came to build their fortunes. And Edward Duplex was one of these guys where he had come all the way from the East Coast with his brother. He wanted to be here and kind of start his own life, and saw all these people rushing to a lot of the fields, the streams, the rivers.
Yeah, he comes here during the gold rush. He arrives here.
Yeah, during the gold rush, right?
Yeah, depending on the narrative. He arrives here 1852, 1854, somewhere in there. Early in statehood.
Exactly.
However.
And so if you go to a place, Marysville, which is not far from Wheatland, where I live, it's the largest city in Yuba County. There's really two cities, Marysville and Wheatland. And in Marysville, he's producing, product and helping people. And then he really becomes an active voice in the community. And so he decides years later to move out to this little outpost called Wheatland. There was probably a few hundred people here, and it's not far from the Bear River, where you've got a lot of things happening. But at the same time, you also have this little city kind of popping up, and it's not very big. The building still pretty much exists. It's along the main street. There's a little sign, a placard on the wall or on one of the doors. And if you go across the street, it's kind of like an old town main street that you would see in like some Hallmark, movies. It's not a very big town. It's a small town. The police department is in some trailers down the street. There's a firehouse, a post office box around the corner. There's an old Pioneer Hall down the street, and then the Wheatland Historical Society, some school buildings, and what used to be the Masonic Hall, and then like a saloon or hotel in the area. Some of the stuff has changed over the years, but it's kind of an old bucolic town, and he was just the barber. He was the guy that sat there and talked about politics and the comings and goings. And at the same time, you had a lot of Chinese influence in the area as well. They were coming to build out some of the railroad stuff, built a ton of walls in the area. You also had an area of town which the Chinese were kind of like sequestered, like they couldn't go out of this certain area. And if you go down the street that we were talking about towards where I live, Camp Far West area, there's this little town called Horstville, which was also a place where they were growing a lot of hops. And so all these things are like commingling at once, right? Where you have agriculture, you've got a lot of immigration, you have the gold, fields and mining, and just a lot of frontier sort of stuff as well, because this was also the end of the Immigrant Trail for the Donner Party. So, right, it's so fascinating. It's rich with history right here.
Well, part of what's so amazing to me about the story, of course, is that if you listen to the folks who populate our State Reparations Commission, this story would be impossible. It can't happen. Man gets here 2 years after statehood at a point when the Reparations Commission would have you believe there was simply like just this real oppression going on and that African Americans had no fair shake. And yet here's Edward Duplex with his brother arriving from Connecticut. And with a couple of other African American guys, they go into business together, open up a mine, this aforementioned Sweet Vengeance mine. And I love the name. I mean, it is evocative. They are probably, I can't imagine they're not looking across at the South, at the history of American race relations at that point, and saying, you know what, we're going to get our vengeance. We're going to become wealthy. And they do. They become wildly successful. It's a very productive mine. And Edward takes his cash in, I think it's 1854, and that's when he heads to Marysville, starts his first barbershop, hires other black barbers. His brother, I think by this time, has died. It says, I think in a Wikipedia account or somewhere, that he dies of consumption, which sounds like a really severe cold or bad pneumonia. If there are doctors listening, maybe they can tell me what consumption actually is. Sounds like scrofula. No, it doesn't sound like scrofula. Just sounds ancient. So he uses his income to become an entrepreneur. He doesn't just, you know, do what a lot of guys did in the frontier and shoot other people and drink away their proceeds in the local saloon. He becomes a business guy. And as you said, it's in his capacity as a barber that he becomes very familiar with what's going on in his town, very familiar with the comings and goings of people. And he moves from Marysville to Wheatland, but at the same time, he is working through this thing that I had not spent a lot of time thinking about, the colored conventions movement. He was very active in this. You know, this is a man who was an activist. He helped fund newspapers, African-American newspapers, including one called The Elevator. We'll talk about that in a moment. And he's involved in this colored conventions movement, this really prominent group of people in the 1850s and then in the 60s who meet regularly to discuss the situation of African Americans before, during, and after the Civil War. In fact, there's one awesome moment. Let me see if I can find it. I think it's here in the Wikipedia account. Here it is. In 1861, Duplex's name appears on a petition sent to the U.S. Congress. 1861, the dawn of the Civil War. The petition listed the names of 240 California blacks requesting funding to cover the cost of leaving the United States. Wikipedia notes that historian Rudolph Lapp argues that the petition was a symbolic protest against the narrow objectives of the Civil War before the Emancipation Proclamation, rather than a genuine request. But this is an active guy. He's willing to put his name on a document that says, you know what, if you're not going to fight African American freedom, Abraham Lincoln, we're out. Just give us a little cash and we'll leave. And of course, as this guy says, it was much more of a protest. And by this time, you know, there are ample reasons for Edward Duplex to stay right where he is. He is apparently succeeding quite well. Flash forward, and then I want to go fill in some of this detail, but flash forward to 1888, April 11th. And that's when a group of, they're called trustees of the city of Wheatland, make him mayor. And as we've already said, the first African-American mayor in California. What do you know anything about this early period of Wheatland history that would account for its, I'm going to call it, small R Republican virtue?
Yeah, I think this was a town and a country that was dominated by people who were forward thinkers. They were pioneers. They were they just wanted what was best, and that's what I love living about living in this kind of area, is that there's not a lot of, even to this day, there's very little, as I can tell, racial animus within my neighborhood, within the schools, within the community. I think that's goes back to the beginning, and even amongst the people that lived here at that time, there was a very broad mix of population. So the trustees of the small little town, which was, I think, several hundred people, right? It had all the trappings of an old Western town, the blacksmith shop. It has the railroad going through town, which when I go to my kids' Little League games, the Little League field literally is 20 yards from the rail line. So every game,
the original rail line.
Yeah. So every game that train still comes through, it's very active line. You will hear the horn and you can't hear balls and strikes for about 30 seconds to a minute, depending on how long the train is. There's a lot of lumber that comes through there, rock, other oil, other things that come through on that line, which I think is pretty much the same line that has existed for, 150 years in the area. And so it was really a center point of commerce, but also led you into the hills. And again, we talk a lot about gold being discovered in Coloma, which is, a few miles east of us here. But there is a story that the gold was actually discovered in the Bear River just down the hill from where Edward became mayor. And again, a guy who was prospecting up in Marysville, which you go up northwest a little bit. But just a few miles away is where we think that the first gold was actually discovered. And yet, because of translation errors and other things, it was delayed for several years until Sutter's Mill became quite the place.
Wow. It's so evocative. You describe standing out on this Little League baseball field and you see the old train line still in use. It reminds me of that great line from William Faulkner, famous, of course, as a novelist, but also a Hollywood screenwriter. Faulkner, who said, "And as I lay dying, the past isn't dead. It isn't even past." There it is, right there. You could reach out and touch that building where Edward Duplex worked. So there's something also interesting here, and that is again, I don't want to pound political pegs into narrative holes here, but this is an African American man who really does so many brave things, but is met with, at least in Wheatland and Marysville, he is met with real open-handedness on the part of the white majority. You recommended a link. I think it's called blackpast.com. It's a website that does what it purports to do. But that's where I think I found the link to a story in the elevator. It's a newspaper article from, what is this, August 8th, 1874, Lance. So 1874 is 14 years before Duplex becomes mayor, but he's already in Marysville and he's working there to end the segregated colored school. As I read this, it's a little bit complicated because it just this story is kind of without context, but it appears that there was a church basement in Marysville where African American kids were sent to school. One teacher, all classes. You can imagine how complicated this was. And so who comes to the trustees of the city of Marysville and the school board there and asks them to maybe consider the possibility of opening a public school that includes black kids? And to fund it. Now, I believe it does not say this, but I believe because this appears in the elevator, the African-American newspaper, and because Duplex was a supporter of and contributor to the elevator, it's possible this was written by him, but there's no byline on this story. Didn't do a whole lot of bylines back then. But it says the entire board, this is straight from the article, Commissioner Davis of the committee appointed at the last meeting to consider the petition of colored citizens asking for a graded school or the admission of colored children with the other schools made a verbal report favorable to granting said petition. Now, I wonder if you unpack that line, Lance, what you hear is, hey, will you build us a separate school for our kids? And if you don't want to do that, how about you just let us into your white school? Now we don't know from this article, I wasn't able to tell, and I haven't been able to do the deep research on it, but he continues, the author does, the questions involved were discussed with the board. The entire board appeared to be favorable to the admission of colored children into the various schools. This would seem to be desegregation they're contemplating here in Marysville, 14 years before he becomes California's first black mayor. So the story concludes, the committee examined it and said they agreed that this should happen. And the story concludes, the Board of Education of Marysville has taken a step in the march of progress. Why not complete the good work so auspiciously begun and abolish the colored school altogether? It is proscriptive, anti-Republican, and expensive, and is of no practical utility whatever. He was an education reformer, Lance Christensen, who is also an education reformer. One of your forebears, as we would call it in the Catholic Church, perhaps a patron saint of Lance Christensen's. So, really remarkable guy. And you had one other thing that I thought was really fascinating in your notes to me on this. The Donner Party. Tell us who the Donner Party was and what their connection is to the city of Wheatland, where Edward Duplex becomes mayor in 1888.
Right, so you have the Donner Party making its way west in the 1840s, and of course, it split at some point in time, I think back in Wyoming, with the main part of the party went south of the Great Salt Lake and made their way across much of the desert, hit the mountains at an inopportune time, and when all that happened, of course, we're having a really difficult go of it, and because of that, got stuck in the snow in the Sierras. If you go up to Donner Lake, which is one of my favorite landmarks, actually, up at Donner Lake, there is a massive statue that represents where they were, and it's just down kind of around the corner from where they actually had set up a hut, a small cabin to weather the winter, and where some of that of the pleasant things happen. And if you look at that statue, below.
Because there may be children listening, and children will...
I'm trying to move along without discussing those kinds of things.
They purportedly ate one another.
Purportedly. It's a difficult conversation to have, and there are different... There are people that feel differently about how that all happened.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought this was just sort of by common agreement. We assume that...
Popular story. But, you know, I think that... sometimes it can sound a little more gruesome than it may have been. And again, it was tragic. We'll just put it that way. Right. Yeah. And so they get to this place and they're stuck. But if you go to the monument, one of the coolest parts is the monument goes up, I think it's like 24 feet, and it represents the amount of snow that they had at that point in time that winter. And so they get stuck in this monument. They make several attempts to try to get out. And as you come down the mountain, you make your way towards Sacramento. Wheatland happens to be like the end of this sort of trail. And in 2022, it was 175th anniversary of them coming in to town. And as you go down the road, you can see the Johnson's Ranch plaque, where they came in and were found by some of the explorers out here in Sacramento, and then eventually taken to Sutter's Fort. And Mary, and I can't say her last name, I screw it up every time. One of the women who was here married Johnson, Mr. Johnson of Johnson's Ranch. He was abusive, not very good husband. She left and went to Marysville before it was Marysville, and married one of the prominent citizens there, and then they ended up naming Marysville after her. So wow. It's like there's all these just amazing connections between these parties, peoples, travelers, immigrants, pioneers. This really is a very Western pioneer place, and it continues to have that feel to this day. And a lot of independent thinkers, people who just want to be left alone and do their thing, live in this area still.
What a place. Edward Duplex, first African-American mayor of any city in California, on April 11th, 1888, he is elected mayor of the city of Wheatland. With us, Wheatland expert and colleague and friend Lance Christensen. Lance, thanks for joining us. That's all the time we have today. Thanks for spending your time with us. You can always find Radio Free California on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and far better for us if you subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. You can email us your comments and story suggestions, including anniversaries, birth dates, and other auspicious occasions for us to mark the history of California. On behalf of my friend Lance Christensen and my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, and Glenn Hall, and to our friends at National Review Podcast, particularly producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi. That's the LA-based mariachi and metal band for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.